Hello and welcome to episode 27 of the Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life podcast. My name is Marcus Freestone, and this week is part 4 of our continuing mini-series on negative thinking and how to avoid it rather than how to attain it, obviously, given the title of the podcast. And shortly I'll get on to talking about something that came up during a piece of correspondence with a listener this week. A piece of correspondence, that's rather kind of old-fashioned and poncy, isn't it? A message, an email to be precise, an email little chat with a listener. And so I'm going to be talking in a minute about anxiety and the role anger plays in that, because that's something the listener was interested in. But firstly, I'm going to talk about some positive thinking that I've been doing the last couple of days. So this morning I went for a walk to the supermarket just after 6 a.m, as is a frequent habit of mine, being an insomniac with chronic pain. If I hang around in bed too much or stay at home too much, sitting in front of the computer, which is how I spend most of my waking hours, it's not good for the pain and it's good to get out. So I went out because I couldn't sleep and I needed some food. So I was walking along and I suddenly realized that I felt kind of happier than usual. And I thought, why is that? And for once, I didn't have my headphones in. I thought, oh, I'll have a break because I've been working on music. So in fact, I've been up most of the night working on music on headphones. So that's why I thought, give me ears a break, because you need to clear them out. And so I thought, well, it's not music or anything I'm listening to. I thought, I feel kind of quite buoyant. And I thought, oh, it's the weather, because I could detect that today was genuinely the beginning of spring. And if you heard last week, you'll hear how much havoc the tiny amount of winter we have here in an inch of snow caused the country to grind to a halt. But I thought, I thought this is the fact that it's beginning of spring and it's a kind of pleasant, you know, cool but not cold day, and it feels kind of fresh and nice. And I thought, I'm so enjoying just simply walking along the road to the supermarket. I seem to be getting an unfeasible amount of happiness, almost joy, out of this. And I thought, that makes me think of something my girlfriend, who's a Christian, often says, which is, you know, it's important to take pleasure from the simple things in life and be grateful for what you have and not focus on what you don't have. And although I'm not a Christian and I have no religious belief or spiritual belief or metaphysical belief whatsoever, I think that's a really great thing to practice. And also it ties in with existentialism, which is deal with what's in front of you, not what you would like to have in front of you. In existentialism, all we have is, the only reality is now. Now is the present, is everything. The past is an illusion. The future is unknown. You can't predict the future, and you can't change the past. All you can do is act and be conscious in the present, be in the now. It's a sort of the Buddhist thing. And I realized that subconsciously I was practicing this morning. And that's something I'm going to talk about more next week when I go on to talk about Colin Wilson and the subconscious and Gurdjieff. It made me think about being, again, another sort of Christian or spiritual idea is being grateful for what you have and not, you know, lusting after things that you don't, that you think you want or you think you need. And because decades of social science research have shown that if you win the lottery, you suddenly get millions of quid, or you suddenly get a huge amount of money or success, it makes you happier 3 to 6 months. And if you check in with the people 12 months later, they've gone back to their previous average level of happiness. It doesn't really make that much difference. And the secret of long-term mental health and happiness is the constant setting and achieving of realistically achievable short-term goals and constantly ticking things off and, right, I want to do this. I've done it. Now I'm going to do this. I've done it. Now I'm going to do this. I've done it. And that's the way I've lived my life for the last few years, and it makes a huge difference. But as I got back to my little flat, I was thinking about the idea of being grateful for what you have and just accepting your reality as it is, rather than, you know, my mother used to say when I was a kid, oh, you'll wish your life away. Because when I was a kid, I was constantly thinking, oh, I wish this was different, or, you know, I wish I wasn't like this, I wish I was a different person, I wish I could have this, I wish I could do that. It was one of the few useful things she said. She was right, and I've spent most of my adult life until quite recently, you know, wishing I could rewrite my past and going after unrealistic futures rather than accepting what I have now. And that I realized this morning when I got home, what I have now is pretty great. I've talked in the last few podcasts about how I moved to this area in this flat about 7 years ago, and I've had a lot of, my health physically and mentally has been a lot worse since I lived here until recently, and I'm just coming to terms with it now. But where I live is very isolated. It's an hour and a half walk to anywhere apart from my girlfriend, who thankfully only lives a short walk away, otherwise I'd gone completely insane by now. But all my friends and anywhere that I want to go is two bus rides or an hour and a half or more walk away, and so I've been feeling pretty isolated here. But you know, I got home from my flat this morning, and I got home to my flat this morning from the supermarket, and I was having breakfast and a cup of tea, and I sat on my sofa and I was listening to the birds outside, because the small block of flats where I live, there's a nice garden outside, and it's a really nice view out of my living room window, as I'm looking at now. There's lots of trees, and, you know, there's birds tweeting outside, and there's cats wandering around, and it's a nice picturesque view. And my living room is where I have my recording studio and my study, and it's where I basically live my life, where I do all my work, my books, my music, and my podcast. And, you know, I have a roof over my head, I have food in my stomach, I have my basic needs taken care of, my basic medical needs, and I'm sitting here on my sofa now with a cup of tea, I'm using my computer, I'm recording a podcast, which I'm going to upload to the internet using Wi-Fi, and I can write novels, and I can make music and do this podcast, and I can do pretty much anything I want, all the things I dreamed of as a child. And I've realized that although, you know, yes, I would like to earn a lot more money than I do now, I don't have very much money, but compared to 90% of people in the world, I am rich beyond my wildest dreams. And I think I'm in the top 10% of the luckiest, most privileged people in the world. And growing up, I felt that I was in the bottom 10%. But now that I can come to a much more realistic, clear-headed, thanks to the recent medication, that my head's clear of all the junk, I can come to a much more realistic assessment of my life and think, wow, I'm so bloody lucky. My life is actually pretty damn wonderful. Yes, I have chronic health conditions that are annoying and take up a lot of my time, and sometimes they're painful and upsetting, but generally speaking, my life's pretty bloody fantastic. And, you know, I'm feeling a level of happiness and contentment now that I've never felt before, and my circumstances haven't changed, except for the fact that my career is going a lot better because I'm in a positive frame of mind. So I'm getting things done and approaching things in a positive manner. And I'm working out how to overcome obstacles rather than saying, oh, well, I'll just give up on that because I can't do it. So whilst I would counsel everyone listening about the dangers of all this self-help guru nonsense about you can be whatever you want to be, I've talked about that. No, you can't just decide to be an astronaut and go to the moon and then just go and do it. No, you can't do things like that. There are biological and psychological and social and logistical and physical and financial limitations on everyone. Nobody is completely free to do what they do. Even the president of America, thankfully, not to get political, but, you know, what's he achieved? Nothing really, like most of them. So while that kind of metaphysical, you know, if you commune with the universe, it will make your dreams come true. I don't know why I was doing a bit of a Carl Sagan impression then. I've been hearing spinning in his grave. Anyway, that's just my generic, I don't do voices, that's just my kind of generic Californian hippie voice. For most people, certainly, as I said before in a previous episode, if you're listening to this podcast, you were also one of the top 10% most privileged people in the world because you have access to the internet and you have an electronic digital device on which you can listen to this podcast and you have the time to listen to it. You have half an hour out of your day to listen to this. You're not working in a sweatshop. Or, well, you may be listening to this while working in a sweatshop. I hope you're not. I mean, not that I don't want people working in sweatshops to listen. Do you know, well, that's a kind of intractable argument. Let's let's not go there. Anyway, the point is, if you get in a positive frame of mind and you come to a clear-headed assessment of your life, you'll probably find that your reality is a lot better than your depression or anxiety would have you believe. So a couple of days ago, I was getting ready to go to my girlfriend's place to spend the evening with her. And I thought, oh, I've got this annoying pain in my leg. It's been bugging me for a few days. It feels like it's swollen and that it feels bruised and swollen as if I've hit it really hard. But I know I haven't. It's just, I don't know, the random machinations of chronic pain are bizarre and can change from hour to hour. But I was thinking, oh, no, I got into a negative frame of mind in a state of anxiety, a kind of automatic thing from previously in my life. Well, because I've spent most of my life in that state of mind until a few years ago, and it just comes back sometimes. And I thought, oh, no, I better text her and cancel. And then I started getting agitated. I thought, oh, no, she'll be disappointed because she's looking forward to seeing me and I'm looking forward to seeing her. I cook a meal for when she gets home from work, and I thought, oh no. And I thought, oh, how am I gonna text her and word it in such a way she doesn't feel rejected. And then I had a kind of, rather than have a negative prompting, rather than having a negative voice from my subconscious, I had a positive thing. And I thought, hang on a minute, what am I worrying about? So I've got a pain in my leg. I can still walk. I've got a walking stick I use sometimes. I'm perfectly physically capable of doing the 20-minute walk to my girlfriend's flat. Just because I've got a bit of a pain in my leg, that's no reason to ruin my day and ruin her day as well. Why should I not go there and enjoy my life and see the person that I love and I want to spend the rest of my life with? What's going on here? Why am I being so negative? Yeah, I've got a pain in my leg. I've had pains in my legs for 15 years. Why should that stop me doing anything? And I thought, no, sod it. I'm not. And I had my phone. I was just starting to type a text. And I thought, no. And I cleared the text. I cancelled it. I put my phone down. I put my shoes on. I packed my rucksack. And I picked my stick up. And I walked. And I went out the door and I walked to the supermarket, got some food. I walked to a flat. It was about half an hour and I really, really enjoyed the walk and my leg didn't hurt at all. And I thought, well, there you are. I was worrying about nothing. And lots of studies in social science have shown that 80% of what we worry about will never happen. I'll say that again. 80% of what you worry about, what you're anxious about, is never going to happen. And I can attest to the veracity of that statistic because I spent 30-odd years worrying constantly about all sorts of imagined future disasters. And two or three years ago while I was going through old writings of mine and going through old notes and little journal pieces I'd written on my computer, found lots of stuff from years ago, going back about 10 years that I hadn't read for since I wrote them. I think it was when I was putting the book together. And I went through all this stuff and I looked at all these disasters that I was predicting in my life. And there were dozens and dozens of small to major things. I was thinking, oh, you know, this is going to happen. And then that means that I'm going to be worse off in this respect. And oh, and then I don't know how I'm going to cope when this happens. And I can't deal with this. And I went through it all. And there were dozens and dozens, maybe a hundred of these negative future events I was predicting. And I went through them all and I realized not a single one of them ever happened. Not even that one of the negative things happened and it wasn't as bad as I thought. They never even happened. It was all completely imaginary. It was what psychologists call catastrophizing or catastrophic thinking, where you take a tiny event or you imagine something and you think, oh, how would I cope if this happened? And then you think, oh, well, when this happens, then that will lead to A will lead to B and C and D. And then, oh, my life's completely screwed and my life's over and disaster. And if you're of a depressive frame of mind, as I used to be, you'll extrapolate this eventually to, oh, well, I can't cope with all that, so I'll have to kill myself. And I think in my own experience, a lot of anxiety and a lot of suicidal thinking and depressive ideation comes from what Sartre called anxiety at future self. So this brings me on to the question that the listener asked in the email this week. After listening to last week's episode, where I talked about the links between depression and anger, she asked me, do you think anxiety is linked to anger? She said, I don't often get depressed, but I often have a high level of anxiety, but I don't feel angry. And that made me think, I'd never really thought about, well, until the last couple of weeks, I hadn't thought about a link between anger and depression. And I realized that anger is, I think, a major component of depression. Listen to last week's episode if you haven't already and you want to know my conclusions on that. But I never thought about anxiety and anger. And thinking about it now, I'm not sure that there actually is a link, to be honest. I think, although anxiety and depression are often linked, I think they are not two sides of the same coin. Or if they are, it's only in the sense that they are both negative ways of thinking, negative views of yourself and the world. And so if you have one, you're more likely to have the other. But it's the same with OCD. You can have obsession without compulsion and vice versa. The two don't necessarily go together. And I've realized in my life, although I still have, I think, small elements of OCD, I think that my problem is compulsion rather than obsession. I don't think I get obsessed with things in a clinical sense. I mean, I get obsessed with, you know, I mean, yesterday I sat down at the computer and started working on some music. And 7 hours later, I realized that I barely moved from the computer apart from periodically going up to put the kettle on. And 7 hours had just gone by like nobody's business because I was so entrenched in the music. And so I guess you could say that's obsessive, but I see that as a positive form of obsession. I don't see that as obsession. I see that as passion and enthusiasm. I don't think that's obsession. I don't think I get obsessed with things, but for me, it's more a compulsion you know, my problem is, it, you know, if you put any amount of food in front of me, I will eat a lot of it, regardless of whether I'm hungry or not. And the same goes for, you know, alcohol or cigarettes or whatever, you know, which is one reason why I don't drink whiskey anymore, because once I haven't had whiskey for 10 years, because once I'd opened the bottle, I would just drink the whole lot neat. And last time I did that, it was, you know, I drank a whole bottle on a Saturday afternoon, and that was, that ended very badly in some unpleasant incidents. So I think, so you can have obsession without compulsion and vice versa. And you can have depression. You can have depression and anxiety, but I think depression and anxiety are separate clinical, or they are separate mental events. They're often linked because they're both negative ways of thinking. And if you have a certain kind of personality, you'll be prone to both. But I believe they are separate. So whilst I think depression is very much linked with anger, I don't think anxiety is, in my experience. Maybe you disagree with me. If you do, let me know. Email me, marcus.freestone@yahoo.com, or go to the Facebook page, send me a message, Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life on Facebook. But I don't think they are linked. So if anger isn't the cause of anxiety, then what is? Well, I mentioned earlier Sartre's concept of anxiety at future self, and I think I'll talk about that in detail in a couple of weeks, because my plan is next week I'm going to talk about Colin Wilson, and then I think the week after I'm going to talk about the work of Camus, and then after that I think I'll cover Sartre, and then I think maybe Nietzsche or Dostoevsky. I've done a whole episode on Ouspensky, a whole episode on Gurdjieff. I did a whole episode on Camus and the Myth of Sisyphus, but I think there's stuff left unfinished. So I'd like to move on and do something on all of those, starting with Colin Wilson next week. But I think that the main component of anxiety is, as Sartre said, it's anxiety at future self, which is the impossibility of predicting your own future with any degree of accuracy. It's been demonstrated, I think, that no matter, even if you had the most powerful super quantum mega computer in the universe, it is, by the laws of physics, it is impossible to accurately predict the weather beyond, I think, about 30 days, because beyond that, then chaos theory comes into play, and there are just so many factors involved, you just cannot accurately predict the future beyond a few days. You just can't. If you look at your own life now, and you know the circumstances of your own life, you know what your hopes and desires are, you know what your fears are, you know what your dreams and your ambitions are, you know how likely you are to achieve them. So if I say to you, what's your life going to be like in a week's time, then you could give me a fairly accurate prediction of that. And you would be probably 90% accurate. I mean, obviously, you can't 100%. If I said to you, in a week's time at, you know, 3 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon, precisely what are you going to be doing? I mean, you might say, oh, well, I know at that time I'm going to be in work, or I'm going to be, or I have a doctor's appointment at that time, or I'm going to be doing this. But you never know. I mean, you know, you might not be in work at that time. You might have to call in sick, or your doctor's appointment might be cancelled. You might be doing something else. Tomorrow you might run into an old friend you haven't seen for 20 years and end up going for a drink with them and, you know, rekindling a relationship with them or whatever. So you can't be 100% accurate, but you could be fairly certain what generally the substance of your life is going to be like in a week's time. But if I say, what's your life going to be like in a year's time, then things become more uncertain. And if I say, what's your life going to be like in 10 years' time, 20, 30 years' time, then you have pretty much no idea absolutely no idea what your life's going to be like in decades' time. It's just, it's completely unknown. I deliberately used the word there, uncertainty. The further you go into the future, the more uncertainty there is. And I think, certainly in my experience, and again, that's kind of mostly what I have to go on, uncertainty is at the root of anxiety. I've mentioned it many times before on a podcast and in the books, but one of the main psychological elements that we have evolved is a craving for predictability, and uncertainty makes us anxious, because 40,000 years ago, when we last had any significant evolution, if you couldn't predict your immediate environment, if you didn't know what was going to happen next, then you were very likely to be eaten by a saber-toothed tiger, or, you know, you were likely to die from drinking polluted water or eating the wrong type of berry or something. So I think anxiety is about uncertainty, and about, I think it's also thinking about it, this has just occurred to me, but looking at other people I know who suffer badly from anxiety, I think it's a feeling of a lack of control. And I know that I was a very, very, very anxious child. Deliberate use of three varies. I could have said extremely. I was a very, very, very extremely anxious child, because my environment was so unpredictable. And, you know, I grew up without a father, and then when I was seven, my mother remarried, and suddenly there's these people I don't know living in my house, and there's this bloke I don't know and don't like telling me what to do and acting like he has some kind of power over me and some say in my life. And it was all just so confusing and unpredictable. I didn't know where I was, and I was, you know, I was never consulted on anything. Me and my mother had this nice little house, and then we moved from there, and I had to change schools when I was six, and then 3 months later we moved back again. And so I never had any sense of stability, and there was so much uncertainty in my life that it made me extremely anxious. And it's only really the last few years, really since I turned 40, that I've felt like a proper adult and an autonomous human being. And part of that is that I don't have any contact with my parents or anyone in my family anymore. And that has given me autonomy. And now I finally feel that I'm in charge of my own life, and I can make my own decisions, and nobody is going to force me to do anything I don't want to do. And things aren't going to happen without my feelings being taken into consideration, which happened to me every bloody day as a child. So that's why my girlfriend often comments, because, you know, we've known each other for, you know, we were friends for 20 years before we got together, known each other since half our lives, more than half our lives. And she's often commented the last few months that, you know, how are you? She often wonders how I'm so calm when, you know, we're faced with a problem or something, you know, she's anxious over something, and I go, oh, don't worry, I'll sort that out. And just, oh, there you go, done it, no problem. And she said, how are you so calm? And I think it's because I finally feel that I'm in charge of my own life. And so if you're suffering from anxiety, then there's almost certainly going to be a feeling of a lack of control, a feeling that you don't know what's going to happen next, a feeling that there'll be something in your life that is unstable or uncertain, that you don't feel that you have autonomy, and that there is some potential future event that you are worried about, that you feel powerless to avoid. I think that's at the root of anxiety. And this can manifest itself in many ways, obviously. I mean, I mentioned OCD earlier. A lot of people, you know, there are many ways of dealing with anxiety. I think I've said before that I don't believe that alcoholism, drug addiction, eating disorders and all that are, I don't believe they are medical conditions or clinical conditions in and of themselves. I think they are epiphenomena. I think they are what Sartre would call conducts, and we'll come on to that in a couple of weeks. They're epiphenomena, a form of behavior, and the root of all of those things, all of that behavior, is an underlying depression or anxiety. I think depression, anxiety, negative thinking, poor self-image, that is the root problem. Those are the mental conditions, the mood disorders, whatever you want to call them. Those are the root of everything. And self-harm, eating disorder, drinking, drugs, whatever, all those are forms of behavior that comes from the root cause, the depression, the anxiety, the negative thought patterns. And I think it's those three root causes that you have to tackle. So if there's something wrong in your life, if you're, you know, for example, if you're drinking too much, as I did about 15 years ago, I got hammered every night for about 15 months. And in my case, depression was at the root of it, and a kind of existential boredom as well. Because I was doing a full-time job and I was too tired to do anything creative. So my life just seemed pointless. And, you know, just to use drinking as an example, if you're drinking too much and you're aware that you're drinking too much and you feel that you should cut down or stop, but you feel you can't, then that's not a clinical condition in and of itself. You can't say, oh, alcoholism is a disease, so I need to treat that. No, you need to treat the underlying cause. So what's the underlying cause? Is it depression? Is it that you're drinking a lot because you hate your life? There's some kind of circumstance you don't like, so you're just seeking oblivion, or you're anxious, so you're trying to calm your nerves, or that you hate yourself, but you don't quite want to commit suicide, so you're just trying to, it's a form of self-harm, which I think was part of my drinking as well. So you need to look at the root cause of it. And with anxiety, I mean, it could be any number of things, but I think for me, I think it's anxiety at the unpredictability of the immediate future and fear that you can't cope with whatever is going to befall you, that you're not in control. And also with me, a significant component of my anxiety over the years was, I think basically I was kind of trained, not deliberately, obviously, but I was programmed, that's a better word. I was programmed subconsciously by my circumstances and my behavior as an infant to just be in a constant state of anxiety. And if you're in a constant state of anxiety or depression or stress or whatever for years, for decades, then when those circumstances change and the reasons for you to be anxious stop being there, when your life changes and improves, you'll often find that you continue being anxious because it's a pattern of learned behavior. And as I was saying, the example I mentioned earlier at the beginning about the other day when I was going to go to my girlfriend's and I thought, oh no, I can't because I've got this pain in my leg, I'd better cancel. That was the negative part of my subconscious. That was my 40 years of training for anxiety kicking in. In the past, even a year ago, I would have given into that. And that we've had lots of problems in our relationship a year or two ago where I would constantly be cancelling on her for reasons that really kind of weren't justification for anything. Oh, I'm too tired to do this, or I feel too ill, or I was just in this constant state of negativity. And now that I'm not in that, thankfully, anymore, I can see much more clearly, and I can see that it's negative programming that's doing it. And as I said before in the podcast, it only takes 2 weeks to change a pattern of thought, a pattern of behavior. So what you need to do, and I'll talk about this in detail next week, because this is very much what a lot of Colin Wilson's work was about. What you need to do is sort of perform CBT on yourself, cognitive behavioral therapy. That's what I've been doing for years. It's a massive help. You need to reprogram your subconscious in the way that Gurdjieff and Ouspensky and Colin Wilson talked a lot about. And you need to, I don't want to say something as cheesy as turn a negative into a positive, but that's kind of what it is. Or to use a more clinical scientific term, reframing. So I think I've rambled on for long enough this week. So I'll conclude this podcast for now. But so next week I'll talk about Colin Wilson, and I'll talk about reframing and about reprogramming your subconscious and learning to notice the negative patterns and learning to think and behave in a more positive way. So there we are. That was episode 27 of Positive Thinking of the Meaning of Life. My legs have gone a bit numb now from sitting on this sofa for so long, but hopefully that's been useful to you. So stay positive, and I'll see you next week. Please, even if you don't get this podcast from YouTube, can you please go to the YouTube channel, Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life, and subscribe to it, because then at least you'll get a notification when the new episodes are up, even if you get the MP3 from iTunes or Stitcher or wherever it's available from. Yeah, today I'm going to be putting up some new cover versions on the Marcus Freestone YouTube channel. Please go there and like and subscribe to that. A couple of days ago, I put up Stand and Deliver by Adam and the Ants, which is the first single I bought with my own money when I was 8. Today, I am putting up, I'm really pleased with, Personal Jesus by Depeche Mode. I'm really pleased with the version of that I've done. That's what I was working on for 7 hours straight yesterday and most of the night as well. I'm really pleased with that. And also, I've done a version of Come On Eileen by Dexys Midnight Runners. Those of you outside of the UK may not be familiar with that. That's another up-to-date song from 1982. If you could go and buy one of my novels or one of my albums, I make music as Marcus Freestone, Industrial Strength, Mosher, and Space Music Industries and Electric Chill Incorporated. Go to marcusfreestone.com. There's tons of stuff there. There's loads of free music to download and free ebooks, including The Positive Thinking, The Meaning of Life, the free ebook. The paperback's also available. I'm currently working on doing an expanded third edition of that, which should be out in a few weeks. Yeah, and if you could go on PayPal and chuck me a couple of dollars or pounds or yen or, I was going to say shekels. That's shekels, not a currency, is it? If it is, it's probably about 0.0 pence. Anyway, and hopefully, I will be going on Patreon soon, and I'm going to work out some way that I can find the time to offer some kind of extra thing, maybe an extra little sort of 10-minute podcast or a little video or a blog or something exclusive for Patreon users. So yeah, because the more money I can earn and the more support I can get from you people, then the more, you know, the longer I can keep doing this podcast every week and the more I can spend most of my time doing this work that people seem to like. So there you are. Stay positive. MarcusFreestone.com. Check out my cover versions on the Marcus Freestone and the Industrial Strength YouTube channel. And I will see you next week. Bye-zy-bye.